Calling all small firm architects, it's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast, it's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Thomas Gluck, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here. Thomas Gluck is a principal at Gluck Plus in New York City, named by Fast Company as one of the top 10 most innovative companies in architecture. Gluck Plus has been recognized for their unique approach to architect-led design build with single source responsibility and architects leading the building process. Architects at Gluck Plus are also construction managers, where feedback between method of construction and design is fluid and responsive. And I know when I started talking about architect-led design build, lots of ears perked up with our listeners. That is a topic that architects love to think about. Lots of them dream about it. Some of them try it, but not enough of them do it. And I'd love to have that conversation with you today, Thomas, to sort of walk through how you do it, how you successfully do it, and how you deliver your projects. And sound like a good conversation to have?
Sounds great.
All right. Let's before we do that, let's start with you and your story. I want to know how you became an architect. Where did you discover your passion for architecture, and maybe who or what inspired you to become an architect?
Sure. So I have to go back pretty far. As I think some of you may or may not know, I work with my father. He founded the firm 50 years ago. So it's depending on how you look at it, you could say it was, you know, 52 years ago that when I was born. But it took me a little while to find the profession. I had done more science and other things like that, and then got into actually construction. That's really what led me to it. I was fortunate and lucky to have an opportunity. I lived in Japan when I was a child, and I worked for a tea house builder. So I got involved with the making of things before I got into the designing of things.
How old were you when you did that?
I was 16, high school.
And so building tea houses in Japan, 16?
Well, building tea houses, you know, sweeping, carrying lumber.
Yeah, doing the things that a 16-year-old would do on a construction.
Loading and unloading. Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like
I did the same thing, but I was in Hackensack, New Jersey. So it's
almost as exotic. but it was a good experience. And then I started in college really getting into design through set design and set construction. And they were hand in hand always, which is sort of in a college setting fairly common. And it was phenomenal because in set design, you're going through the whole design to construction to feedback loop in 2 or 3 months, and then strip the whole thing back to black and then start over again. So in a very short time, you get that whole, you know, in architecture, it can be 5 years from when you think of something to when you actually see it. And it's a pretty long, slow feedback loop.
Yeah.
So that was really when I got into it.
So your father was an architect, is an architect. So what is, did you always know? Did you know that that was your future? Or
no, I really didn't. It was, you know, I think in retrospect, people say, oh, he was, you know, sure he was going to be an architect from early right. on. I was exposed to it, obviously, yeah. Exposed to looking at things in different ways, just, you know, as a member of a family of an architect. But it wasn't until I actually started doing it myself in the theater that I realized this is something that I really, really was excited about doing.
A lot of children of architects reject architecture.
Those are the smart ones.
Yeah, maybe because I've heard that story before where architects, you know, my children are like, no way, are we going to become architects? And I also think that there are a lot of architects who discourage their kids from becoming architects. Which
I was discouraged, but I'm stubborn. So
interesting. So what did your father hope that you would do?
I don't think he really had a strong preference for what I would do. It's just that, as you know, and I think as young small firms know, and he was a young small firm, it is a very, very difficult profession.
Yeah.
So
he just didn't want you to struggle.
Yeah, it's you get into it for one reason and then you end up spending very little time doing the things that you think you got into it for. Right. And I think this may be a good segue into architect-led design build, because it's really turned a little bit that on its head. It makes things easier. We have more in terms of design. You have more control and it can be less frustrating than a traditional method, design, bid, build delivery system. And for my father and for me personally, and for almost everyone in our office, there are people who get into design because they are interested in conceiving and creating something, but also the making of it, as yeah. opposed to those who are interested maybe only in the conceptual end of something. And that's where the interest kind of ends. And then the rest of it is kind of out there. But if you're interested in the full trajectory of that and seeing something as a concept, an idea, be manifested in physical form and occupied and used, then architecture is like the perfect profession.
Right.
And that's essentially what we do.
So before we get into how you do it and how the firm is structured, because I want to understand all of that. How did it start? How did it start as an architect-led design build firm, or was it first architecture and then you discovered that this was an opportunity?
It was first architecture, and it evolved slowly, and it evolved in a, you know, so right now I can put slides up of $40 million buildings, high-rise buildings in Manhattan that we designed and built. That's sort of a terrifying idea.
Yeah.
It would have been impossible for us to start there, not only for lack of opportunity, but just the thought of that is overwhelming. But that's not how it evolved. It evolved pretty start small and organically grew in a way that I think almost every architect can understand, which is, so I always ask architects, I said, if you were renovating your house or doing an addition or an apartment renovation, and it was for yourself, you would design it for sure. And you probably would not hire a GC to finish it. You probably would go to specific contractors and kind of manage it yourself, because you know, one, you can deliver it for probably, it'd be cheaper to do that way. But you have more control and it's your place and you're comfortable with it and you're not having to worry about all the risk. You know that the client in that case is unlikely to sue you because it's you. And so that's essentially the model that we started with. It wasn't a personal project. We were working on a remarkable opportunity. It was an addition to a Mies van der Rohe house in Connecticut. It was not only a labor of love, but also a real responsibility to do this, to build it properly. And we had designed it very carefully with all the considerations that you would expect. And the contractor simply wasn't up to the task. our fee didn't really cover it, but there was just no way we could let this thing not turn out well. So we ended up having someone on site full time, you know, kind of blowing the CA budget out of the water, but following construction, following the whole project on site full time, and realized that that as architects, having designed the building, conceived of it, detailed it, understanding all of the issues, understanding the client needs, understanding the budget and all those sorts of things, we were really well positioned to manage the construction. So we don't build. I mean, there is a whole model of design build where there are people out there swinging hammers. There are far more skilled carpenters than anyone we have, and plumbers and masons and, you know, welders and everything else. So that's not what we do. But we manage as architects. We're all, I think, really well, have the right skill set and really well positioned to manage at the highest level a construction project. And that's essentially how it started.
So I want to understand that first project, because Mies van der Rohe building, designing in addition to it, overwhelming responsibility for an architect to begin with. And then you start that project with a general contractor, and that didn't work out. And so you stepped in out of responsibility. Is that how it happened? Is this like, this has to come out right, and so we're going to make sure it comes out right, so we're going
exactly
to invest our time and money into making sure it comes out right?
Exactly. Not a sustainable business model.
Yeah.
And so on the next single family project, we had a client, and we said, you know, we realized that we really could, when we realized that we're not going to be physically building it, that we could manage the various trades and find and source the best carpenters and glaziers and all the other things you need. We proposed to a single family client that we do this for them. And they were thrilled. It's like, oh, you can do that? That's great. Because I don't want to get into, I've had friends all the night, you know, everyone's heard. And this was
right
25, 30 years ago. And it's only gotten more so in the industry. I mean, there's nothing but horror stories about, you know, and fear of construction and all the problems. And it's hurting us, as it's hurting the profession, because architects now are getting a bad name, because somehow if you have an architect, then you're going to end up with all sorts of problems. And maybe it's the architect's fault, maybe it's the contractor's fault, and that whole adversarial relationship, which is kind of the norm, is counterproductive and not good for anybody, us, the contractor, certainly not the owner.
So you start with one single residential project. You said that you've done 40 story buildings that are also architect led design build. Was that simply a decision that we're now going to use that model, and it was organically just grown to that level of process?
It was, and it truly was organic. There were steps along the way. So when it started in single family houses, where you have a single owner who's in control, and they care very much about it, and they want you know, a lot of attention, and they want top quality. And we were doing those cost plus. We were basically contractors as advisors, bit by bit, as we started to look into the economic impacts of it, and the insurance and the liability and all these other things, we realized we really needed to separate ourselves as architects, mm-hmm. and our professional liability as general contractors. So we started to clean things up, and also started to realize that we shouldn't be insured as general contractors and not take on that risk as architects, which is easy to do. That's just about going to the market and paying for it. And it's a cost that every owner is used to paying. There isn't a job that doesn't have a line item for insurance. And then it evolved into being comfortable with an opportunity to work on a smaller institutional project where you pretty much have to guarantee a price. So this is another one of these white knuckled threshold moments where now it's not just I'm doing it because I know I can do it and it's working out well, but we're going to guarantee an owner a price.
Yeah. Now you're responsible for the budget.
Responsible for the budget. But so is every general contractor by and large.
Right.
And I'd say generally architects are as capable, if not maybe a hair more, than the pool of contractors. And if they can do it, why on earth couldn't and shouldn't we be able to? And so, again, I think a lot of this comes from the ideology of office that comes from my father, where he was not scared of taking on challenges. And if there's a better way to do something, whether it's a design solution or in this case, a business model, you can't run away from risk. You have to take on, and with that added risk comes tremendous opportunity and control and responsibility in a good way. So it kind of all went hand in hand. So we started then to do guaranteed prices for small institutions. And bit by bit, as you develop a portfolio, it's easier to convince, you know, other clients. And it's evolved, and it's, at least for us, largest scale, where we're now teaming with CMs and doing an architect-led design build collaboration. The biggest one was a 146-unit, 180,000-square-foot building in Philadelphia, where it's really out of our, I mean, we're 35, 40 people, and we're all architects. And that works on certain size buildings, but at a certain point, we're also spend a lot of time doing things that we aren't the best at, like organizing the job site and the job super, where our real value is where an architect would have value, which is understanding the drawings, being able to identify what's important and what costs money and what doesn't, and where you can save money and where you really can't compromise. And that's all in the, and then the supervision of the day to day, so that things go in properly the first time around. That's kind of where it's gotten to, and that has no upper limit. That we feel like we could do at any scale.
Yeah. So let's go into the details of the structure a little bit, just so people understand what you're doing and how you're doing it and the responsibilities. So you said that you have two separate companies. Is that correct?
So on paper, we have two separate companies. Yep.
Right. So you have a, go ahead.
So the Gluck Plus, the plus stands for more. And it's Gluck Plus Architecture is our architectural company, and Gluck Plus Construction CMC is our construction company. But what's fundamental to the value of it is that we're seamlessly integrated in the office. We're still a small office. We maintain that design office scale, even though we're doing more in terms of scope by building, because we're integrated. If we simply put under one, not even under one roof, but in one building, a series of contractors and a series of architects who are working together, the divisions and all the problems that exist in the world might be mitigated slightly, but wouldn't be eliminated. And in this case, the same people who were cutting foam block models at the beginning of a project are the ones on the job site at 7 opening the gates and closing the job site down at the end of the day. And it's that integration that's so key.
So it's the same team doing both jobs. There's no two separate teams running these projects.
That's right. And by and large, it really comes down to a timesheet thing. So I may fill out the job number for architecture, which is 4 digits front ways, and then the reverse, you run them backwards, and that's our construction job number. And I have 2 hours as an architect on one job, 2 hours on the same job as a construction manager, 2 hours on another job. And that continuity is so critical, because while we're designing, we understand cost. All that information the contractor has is kind of at our fingertips and on our table. And while we're in the field, if there's a little question about which way to do something, we're the ones who came up with the basic premise. And what is the spatial goal of this room? Or, you know, what are we trying to achieve? And yeah, that's a better way to do it. We could save a little bit of money. Nope. Or it's faster. Let's do it.
Yeah. Instant decision making.
Instant decision with the right priorities.
Right.
The problem is there's this giant priority shift when you go from an architect as representing the owner, and then as the contractor who is trying to get things built quickly and cost effectively.
Yeah.
So you know, you don't lose that. You have all three always.
So just this is just out of curiosity. Do you and your employees get two paychecks?
No, we to keep things simple, we all get
that's
one
why
paycheck.
I asked that. Yeah.
We all get one paycheck. The back of house accounting.
Got it.
Leases, we basically have a system where we lease employees. So we have two companies, and the hours get cross-billed, and that all happens behind the scenes in accounting, but it doesn't affect the day-to-day and the operation. And that's part of keeping the feel of this place.
Yeah.
Our single goal is to work on on great buildings and create pieces of architecture. All of this is a tool that we think enables us to do that better. And so as a business model, it could go and probably become quite profitable and quite large if that was our mission, but that's not our mission. We're architects, that's what we care about. And we find this way of delivering buildings to be very powerful to achieve that.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode is brought to you by BQE, the makers of BQE Core, Systems and Standard Operating Procedures. You already know that that's how to build a profitable business and find the freedom you want. You need systems and procedures. But you struggle with choosing which systems you need most and how to implement those systems quickly so you can get back to doing what you love most. The Designing Your Business Masterclass series was created by acclaimed architect and business consultant Douglas Teeger to help fellow architects and engineers run their firms more profitably while maintaining a healthy work-life balance. Douglas grew from a solo practitioner to become managing partner of his 30-plus person firm and then later sold his firm so he can do what he does today, helping architects be more successful at Teeger Consulting. On the third Wednesday of every month, Douglas dives deep into an essential topic that will strengthen the profitability of your firm and make it sustainable for growth in the years to come. Register now for the next Designing Your Business Masterclass with Douglas Teeger at bqe.com/masterclass and start implementing powerful systems for the profitability you need and the freedom you want. Every live masterclass session includes AIA continuing education credit, and when you visit bqe.com/masterclass, you'll have access to the full library of past sessions on demand. The Designing Your Business Masterclass is free, and it's brought to you by our friends at BQE, the makers of BQE Core, the software that makes it easy to manage your projects and people for maximum productivity and ultimate profitability. Register now for the Designing Your Business Masterclass at bqe.com/masterclass. That's bqe.com/masterclass. This episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. There's a lot to love about being an entrepreneur architect, right? But trying to figure out your financials on your own is not one of those things. Luckily, there's FreshBooks, the all-in-one accounting solution that's built for business owners like us. FreshBooks takes all the not-so-fun parts of running a business, from building and tracking invoices to managing online payments to organizing expenses, and automates them with features like the new digital bills and receipt scanner, saving you up to 11 hours per week in the process. 11 hours. FreshBooks has your back at tax time, too. It's almost tax time. With a ton of reports to choose from, you'll know exactly where your business stands, and you can easily hand the keys over to your accountant so they can take over when it's time to reconcile everything for the year. Try FreshBooks. Try FreshBooks for free for 30 days. No credit card required. It's free. Go to FreshBooks.com/architect. FreshBooks.com/architect to get started today. That's FreshBooks.com/architect. So, what will you do with your 11 more hours each week? This episode is brought to you by RCAT.com. We all have that one story, that one project that had such a unique situation that it required a solution that you had rarely considered before. We share these stories in private professional circles with our friends and our colleagues, but there has never been a collection of these stories of conflict and triumph all in one place. Until now. Detailed is a podcast series that features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who share their insights and expertise as they highlight some of the most complex, interesting, and oddball building conditions that they have ever encountered, and the ingenuity it took to solve them. Join host Charisse Lakeside, aka CSI Kraken, a senior specifications writer at RDH Building Science, as she uncovers lessons learned to help you navigate similar challenges that may arise in your next project. Detailed, an original podcast by ARCAT. Listen and subscribe right now at arcat.com/podcast. That's arcat.com/podcast. ARCAT.com/podcast. Detailed. Every building has a story. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So practically, can you sort of run through a typical project and what a project manager would be responsible for? Are they actually designing it and then managing the production drawings, and then that same person is also out in the field making sure that that project is being run properly?
Yeah, so by and large, that's correct. Our project managers, I think I would say maybe without exception, our project managers have done that from through the architectural process as you'd expect it to be, and through the construction. Not everyone on the team, we would move the whole team to the job site as soon as we have the ability to do so. And there may be people doing kind of CA or in the trailer, but we're all together. And so there's a savings and not just a savings in time, but also there's greater opportunity. You can walk out and look at a space while you're designing a piece of millwork. Or if you're reviewing a shop drawing, you can go just get off your desk and walk outside up to the 10th floor or whatever and see what it is you're reviewing. So not everyone functions fully as CMs, but we will move the entire team. You know, obviously there's fewer architect hours in construction than construction hours, but we are, the people generally are the same people and they're doing the same things.
When you're hiring, are you hiring for a specific type of person?
We first and foremost look at design capabilities. And then, like I said previously, people have to be interested in getting their hands dirty, not physically, but we do a lot of stuff that is not glorious, and all architects do, but we do a lot more stuff that's not glorious, like, you know, calling the Port-a-John company and negotiating with them. And so most people don't think about that when they apply to architecture school. So we need people who realize that it's all serving the goal of getting this piece of architecture built. And we have not had problem finding a large body of people who are both good at it and interested and willing to do it.
So from a client side, when they hire you, they're hiring one company or they're hiring both companies?
So we have chosen, and I don't think this is standard. There are many different ways of contracting this, whether you're using AIA contracts or DBIA, Design Build Institute of America contracts, or our own contracts, which is what we've evolved into doing. We have chosen to have two contracts, one as an architect and one as a contractor. So it mirrors, at least contractually, a more traditional design bid build, where you might hire the architect early, they do a search, you find somebody, you sign a contract, and then later you do the construction search. And part of the reason for that is that very often clients are not quite ready, or even in institutions, case, not even able. Like, they may be authorized by the board to hire an architect, but by have absolutely no ability to hire a contractor or commit to design build yet. So it keeps things, because it's still not, I mean, architect by design build is not very common. Design build is getting more and more common. We try to make a very strong distinction, and that's really important people understand. Most design build is contractor-led design build, and we as architects are hired the same way you would hire a plumber or a toilet vendor or any of the other glorious aspects of a building. So the architect-led design build puts us in control and as the leader and not the contractor. So that gives us the ability to contract at different times and allow clients to get to a comfort level and make the decision when they need to and not push them too early.
So you bring in the construction after the design?
We do. We always tell them we can do it. From the very beginning, upfront they know, and upfront they're often very interested, but they're just not sure yet. I mean, the fact of the matter is you don't need to have that conversation yet because, you know, until you know the scope of the building, you can't really do pricing anyway. It's you know, programming and all the things that happen on the front end are really can really be separated from the construction of the building.
Do you have projects where you're not running the construction?
Yeah, absolutely. There, I'd say 30% of the projects we do for one reason or another, doing a big affordable housing project and the developer is a builder, which is a fairly common configuration in affordable housing, or we're working in a big union environment outside of our, you know, New York City, say, where again, it's just not in the cards. And it's fine. What it does bring home for us is every time we do a traditional delivery method, regardless of, and this is not a function of whether it's a good contract or a bad contract or a good client or a bad contract. It's so painful because we see so much lost opportunity from a design standpoint, so much wasted money from an owner standpoint. But you know, we architectural opportunities don't only occur in the design build world. So we certainly can operate that way, but we very much changes the way we draw and the way we think.
Yeah, you have no control during construction. Well, you have limited control during construction when a general contractor is in charge. So you have to do more drawing, more details, more oversight, construction administration.
It's interesting. It's partly that's true. Partly when we're building, I think we do far more drawing actually when we're building because it has to happen sometime. A normal architectural fee cannot cover all the drawing that's required to really build a building, unless it's a very straightforward thing. And so you have to work within your fee. We all do, right? And so when we're building, and often what happens is you get the drawings, which describe the design intent. You know, you read through the AIA contracts, it's very clear what our drawings are supposed to do. And the contractor then has to unpack all that and figure, or the subcontractors have to figure out exactly how it's going to go together. But there's a huge loss of design opportunity and a loss of translation through that process. So we will do a ton more drawing, but we can do it under our CM hat and under our CM fee because that work has to happen. And as architects, it's much more efficient. We know exactly where all the plumbing sleeves for the concrete slab have to go because, you know, we understand all the plumbing drawings.
Yeah, that's super interesting because a general contractor, they wouldn't do that. They would just figure it out on site. They just, you know, have a conversation with the trade and we'll do with that. And then whatever happens, happens, right? And with architects, we can actually design it and figure it out and come up with a solution, design it and check it out and see if that model really works. So if it doesn't work, we can design it the other way. And then when you build it, you know it's going to work. You know what it's going to look like. You know what the materials are. Potentially a lot less cost involved because you've figured out all the details before you actually build it. So I could understand how you'd have a lot more drawings, but be much more efficient.
Right. And it's really important to understand too, that we can't, even though we're experienced design builders, we can't do this ourselves. So we rely tremendously on the trades because the fact of the matter is that one plumber may choose to do plumbing, you know, their risers and stacks and vents and all a certain way, and another may have a different preference. And it's not, one's not right or wrong. I mean, there are wrong ways to do it, but by and large, there's more than one way to do it. And some of it will depend on how they're tooled, how their labor is organized. And so there are cost savings that a mechanical engineer nor an architect can figure out. So we don't do these projects by ourselves, just like an architect doesn't design a building by themselves because they have their whole team of consulting engineers who are like an integral part of the design. As soon as we get into even early estimating, we very much work and collaborate with all the subcontractors. And it's great. So if we're on an early design meeting or working on the design of a facade of a building, and we have an idea conceptually about what we want to do, but we're not sure how to do it, we can just call up the rain screen sub who we've worked with and say, well, what would you do in this case? What do you think is the, and that's not something you can get from vendors, and it's not something you can get from design, whether architects or consultants. It really, they're the ones in the field. They really know And it's a huge fountain of information that we get to tap, not just during construction, but in design. And that's hugely valuable.
Is that a very intentional process that you go through to communicate that respect that you have for your subs to make sure they understand that? Because intuitively, there's this conflict between architects and contractors that contractors aren't respected. And so therefore there's this wall that they put up and architects, you know, goes back and forth. And so you have to be very intentional about that. Is there a process that you go through to make that happen? Or is it just earned over time with working with the same people?
It's earned over time. And it's even earned up front, because when we get, if we have a contractor in, a glazier or cladding person, we're asking questions of them that they're not often asked of. And they know, because they see the drawings they usually get, and they know that this is not the smartest or best way to do it. But on the other hand, you know, CDs are contract documents. It's a contract. So, and of course, there's always, you know, requests for value engineering ideas or different ways of saving money, but not early enough that it can really happen. Contractors generally get their ears pinned back when they deviate from the documents. Whether right. The documents make any sense at all is not the question. It's those are the documents. And so in this way, we're able to, and so often, one, because we're used to speaking with them, we're asking them for their expertise early, which they rarely get the opportunity to do. And they get very excited about doing it. So that doesn't take kind of a period of building up respect. And then when we're actually on a job with people, because we're architects and we understand dimensioning and we know what matters and where we can bring a lot of value and where a contractor can get really hurt is if they lay the wall out wrong and they build it in the wrong place. All the wall could be perfectly built, but if it's not in the right place, it's on them, right, to fix that. Or it's too late, you can't afford to, there's not enough time, and then the architect has to just suck it up, or the owner ultimately has to suck it up. But in this case, we spend a lot of time helping with layout, supervising, double checking things, giving them drawings, dimension drawings that make it easier for them. So once they've been on one of our projects, they all want to keep doing it because it's faster, it's cheaper, they make more money, the owner doesn't have change. It's everyone wins. And the architecture is much better because we're in, like you said, we're in control, and we're not going to end up with, well, the ceiling has to be 6 inches lower because we couldn't get the sprinkler pipe in. You know, we're there on site making sure that every drop is where it needs to be.
Are there places in the project that that sort of slip through the responsibility, the scope? Because I've done architect-led design build on a smaller scale, residential scale. And there's always that that spot where sort of the general trades of the cleanup and the all the little miscellaneous things that typically would be a general contractor's responsibility that they just need to do now is part of your responsibility as the construction manager, that somebody needs to do that. How do you handle that? Does everybody sort of have a very detailed scope of work that they're working with?
So generally, so there's a big learning curve in that one, right? The first time you're like, well, what about the cleanup? What about the general labor? Right. How much general labor do you need for a different size project? So some of that comes with, and that's why kind of growing into something
right.
makes sense. We've a couple things we've done. One, we try to buy labor with the subs, and we're clear about, and we write all the scope sheets. Now every big CM does this, where they write the scope sheets. What's the subcontractor's responsibility for their trash? How far does it go? Is it a pile in the middle of the floor, which is kind of typical? And then general labor will come and take it to the dumpsters. So we write all those scopes and we talk through this with them, and safety protection, like that's all carpentry. Right. And then we've also found, just like you would buy any other trade, you can buy labor, just like you can buy plumbing and glazing and everything. So you can, and then we can use that as a resource. So we now know how to, when we're guaranteeing prices, we have a pretty good sense of how much labor you would need and budget accordingly for it. So you don't get stuck with a big surprise at the end saying, oh, well, We didn't think about that, and now we have a cost that we haven't anticipated.
So it can be handled like just another trade.
It's just another trade.
Yeah. Great. Interesting. So we're thousands of small firm architects are listening to us right now, and lots of them have thought about doing this. I've been talking about encouraging architects to do this for a long time. I see the value in it. I've done it myself. Is there some advice that you have for those architects who want to step into this don't want to do it wrong? Do you have any suggestions, any tips on what they should be looking out for?
I would say that the biggest impediment we see in the industry to starting this is kind of trepidation of the risk that goes into taking something like this on. I really strongly believe that architects are generally extremely well-trained, have the right skill set to do this successfully. Especially, like we did, we started small and worked our way up. There's no way we could have started at the scale we're operating on now. It took 25 years.
Yeah.
I think the biggest single piece of advice would be just do it. Just try it. And you'll see how quickly you'll learn, of course, but you'll see how quickly and how large the rewards are. Yeah. And it won't be that much longer before you realize you really don't want to practice any other way. I think there is partly because of the contracts and this general feeling out there that, there's so much risk and it's so dangerous and there's so much to lose. And the logistics of it is very simple. Separate your professional liability, your personal liability from the contracting one, which every contractor does. And if you can start as an advisor where you can talk to your insurance companies, as long as you're not directly directing people. So as long as you're managing it and you can be an advisor to an owner, basically representative for them, and they hold the contracts, which is how we started.
Yeah.
You've really limited that. And then you have one under your belt. And then with that, then you can go to you can actually get contractor's insurance. It's a little bit of being careful and then just a lot of just go for it.
Yeah.
Go for it and you'll be rewarded.
Yeah. So I just want to put a point on that because that is how we started. We started with that small project. We checked with our insurance company. Our architecture E&O insurance actually covered us up to a certain percentage of projects. And so we did that first project. And kept it under whatever the rule was to keep the insurance coverage on it, and very quickly learned the benefits of architect-led design build, and then grew from there and did a lot of projects that way for many years. And it is just a matter of just doing one, or even in our case, just saying yes, because in our case, we had clients asking us every time we met with them, do you build it too? Right? Just because they didn't know.
Exactly.
And we would just for years say, no, that's not our job. We general contractors. And then one day I just said, yes, we build it too. And then I figured out how to do it. And so that's great advice to just do it and just start small, take on that risk, learn what you need to learn. And then you'll see the benefits of it and you'll want to do more of it. And then you can grow into it.
I firmly believe that.
Yeah.
And I think not only is it good for every individual practitioner, like we're talking about right now, but I think it's fundamental to the profession. I mean, as architects within the greater industry at large, we are more and more compromised, more and more, our scope is getting reduced, our fees are getting reduced because we're doing less and less. And this feedback loop over generations now has architects who really don't know how things go together. And you can't design a great building if you don't know how things are going together. And people are relying on vendors. And vendors are selling product. And yeah, it's safe because everything within that system has been figured out. But that's not the way to make a great building. And so I think we need to, I'd say to every individual small practitioner, just do it. And I would say to the industry, we have to do this. We have to take back. We have to regain respect within the greater building industry within the United States. And it's going to start like one person at a time on a small project, or even your own apartment or your own house addition, and realizing that you can do it. And then bit by bit, we'll all kind of raise the level of our knowledge as architects and understand how things are built, and raise the role of and the feeling of what architects and the value they provide to society. So I don't think we can sequester ourselves away and be satisfied with making pretty, you know, buildings that have great spatial environments and are, you know, well planned. We have to fight for change in what we're doing in our built environment.
His name is Thomas Gluck. The company's name, the firm's name, is Gluck Plus. You can learn more about Thomas and all the work that they're doing at gluckplus.com. That's Gluck Plus spelled out, GLUCKPLUS.com. Go check it out. Doing some amazing work. Lots of it architect-led design build. Thomas, I appreciate you for coming by and sharing your knowledge about architect-led design build. I appreciate the work that you do. Some beautiful work, and thank you for leading the profession and sharing your knowledge here today at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been it's clear we're all passionate about, so it's something that we're all happy to talk about.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, go write a review. I would love to know what you think of this podcast, and it helps other architects find us. So go do 5-star rating if you like it, share, write a review, I'd love it, and share a link to this episode with a friend, because that's how we've grown. That's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands of architects throughout the world, just like you. Thank you to our sponsors, RCAT, FreshBooks, and BQE for their support of this episode. I ask you to support them because they support us. And if they're supporting us, they're supporting you. So go support them. Got it? Go support our sponsors. Links to our sponsors. So you can click on those links and go right to them. Links to our sponsors and all the resources we shared today are available at the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. All the shows are there. entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows. I think there are 11 of them there now. Go there, gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And I hope you're going to join us in Austin November 1st through November 3rd, 2022. Those are the dates for the Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting, our first ever live and in-person conference for you, the small firm architect community. Visit entrearchitect.com/annual meeting right now to learn more. That's entrearchitect.com/annual meeting, and I will see you in Austin in November. Don't miss this. This is going to be great. entrearchitect.com/annual meeting. It's a conference for you, small firm architects. Thank you for listening today to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick. So when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gehry. Visit glengehry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.